Blog Talk Radio.
Let's go. Yeah. Ghetto children singing. See, what up? They eager to learn how to become the next world leaders. Brave hearts. Revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all of them. Gotta you show me if necessary. Homie, vessels is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. But when my mom said, again, you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my empty right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training and difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The armies of school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris, work a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish gills, the cops, the time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa, 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood and one only. Just know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. They'll get the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. Of what we fight for, my heart goes to you beautiful wife in war.
Enlisting more and talk less. Watch all and trust none, demand your respect. And be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom, wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's been.
Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
I'm a soldier for life. The battle I'm fighting has no ending. To struggle is to go the distance. To win is not to care how far one must go.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How you feel?
Fine, sir.
How do we get access to this, Jackson?
His lawyers say they can get me in posing as a legal investigator.
You were Huey Newton's lawyer. And now, Mr. Jackson.
Mr. Jackson was sentenced 1 year to life for a $70 gas station robbery.
We have 2 hours.
Waiting a long time.
We need brothers who can maintain their self-respect in here, have true strength.
Some people are comparing you to Eldridge Cleaver, Richard Wright, Du Bois. How does your fame affect you when you're locked up all day?
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Free the Soledad Brothers!
Do you understand that there cannot be a peaceful revolution?
Okay, gentlemen, we're taking over!
Mr. Jackson,
I'm sorry about your brother.
They will live to regret it. I'll see to that. You hear me, Eric?
Starring Gary Dorden from TV CSI.
This is the military, David.
Revolutionary Greetings. Read the line. This is your host, Conrad Boumane Secure. Welcome to another edition of Georgia University Radio. Our primary goal and aim is to transfer the freedom of the slave contract with your prisoner to begin to learn through education means. Before we go into the show, I'd like to go over something that happened this week in our history, or our story about it. On November 4th, 1879, T. Elkin, invention of the refrigerating apparatus, was patented. November 4, 1942, Dr. Patricia E. Bell, a genius in eye care, who invented the Wiley U machine for cataract treatment, was born. In 1970, in New York, in Auburn Prison, a new prison rebellion broke out. Also, November 4, 2008, Barack Obama was elected President of the United States. November 7, 1841, a successful slave revolt by African abroad, the slave ship Creole. Also, November 7th, 1837, Elijah Lovejoy murdered by pro-slavery mob while defending his printing press in Austin, Illinois. November 8th, 1972, in New Jersey, women's prison in Clinton. It was a prison strike. On November 9th, 1731, Benjamin Banneker, architect, inventor, survey, Washington, D.C., mathematician, born in 1731. Also, November 7, 1972, police killed two new African students at Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in a peaceful demonstration. On November 11, 1887, the Hayward Market martyrs were hanged. 1831, November 11. Slave rebellion leader Nat Turner was hanged. Also on November 11, 1975, an Angola African gang independent from Portugal under the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA. Those are all the events I see right now happening in a particular week. I'll say free land, identified land, revolutionary greetings. All right, we're gonna tell our show tonight. Brother Kamal Franklin, how you doing, good brother?
I'm doing good, my brother. Can you hear me good?
Yes, I hear you well, brother. Good to have. Again, I want to tell you thank you for coming to our broadcast, sharing our understanding, your experiences. Welcome to our show. Can you tell the people, liberty people, about yourself before we get started?
Sure. My name is Kamal Franklin. I've been a community organizer and lawyer for approximately, I don't want to date myself too much, but I guess I got no choice, for approximately 25, 30 years, originally from Brooklyn, New York. I've done everything from working with political prisoners, was in the Malcolm X grassroots movement for about 18 years, started several organizations, the organization I'm with now is called Community Movement Builders, a believer in self-determination, organizing for black folks, because the only way for us to get out of this mess is for us to organize ourselves and our communities. And so I'm just happy to be here to talk about the work that I'm doing now, maybe some of the work that I've done in the past. And to talk about the experiences that we all think is going to lead us to some kind of liberation in the near future.
True indeed. Can you tell the people about your organization, Community Movement Builders, Inc.? Tell the people about your organization, what it does, and why was it founded?
Most definitely. So Community Movement Builders was founded about 4 years ago in Atlanta, Georgia, and currently we have a total of three chapters, another chapter in Dallas, a third chapter in Detroit, and potentially a fourth chapter in the West Coast. We'll talk about that when it happens. And Community Movement Builders does two main things, I would say. We do community organizing, where I would call us a place-based organization. So we actually organize, live, work in the communities that we do the work in Atlanta, Georgia, for instance. We have a community house in the Pittsburgh center of Atlanta where we do community organizing against gentrification. Folks don't know, Atlanta, which is supposedly the Mecca of Black America, is currently gentrifying. And the Pittsburgh area in Atlanta, southwest Atlanta, is one of the last few places in the city that's predominantly Black and working class. And so we're working there doing community organizing with the folks there to create what we would call liberated territory, to fight to keep that community black, to develop resources in that community. And that leads to the second thing we do, which is what I would call sustainability work. So we do work to create cooperatives and micro businesses to bring resources to our community. And the ones that we are working on currently involve, we're doing a trucking cooperative, a kale chip cooperative, an aquaponics cooperative, and a security cooperative. And so we're working on those things as we speak. And, you know, our goal is to make sure that the resources of the particular black neighborhood that we work in, which will extend out to the larger city, remain in the hands of working class and poor black folks. We have to figure that out, because if we don't, we can never really truly have a revolutionary time, because we won't have the ability to carry it forward, because we won't have the institutions, the resources necessary to make something happen. And so we're working on that with some great members and some great people from around the country. So really proud of what we've done in a short period of time that we've been up and running. And soon, you know, people across the country are going to hear about us and the great work that we do.
True indeed. I actually saw in your bio that you speak about a liberation and freedom school for the youth. Can you tell exactly what it is, a liberation and freedom school for the youth, what exactly it is, and what's the goal of it, purpose?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So we do, over the years, I've helped create, you know, what we colloquially would call freedom schools, liberation schools, African and or new African scout programs. And those things are geared to work with black youth, to teach black youth about the importance of, like, our history here as a people who have been resisting colonialism and fascism, white supremacy, capitalism. And what is the history of resistance for our people in this country? And quite frankly, what's the history of our folks across the globe in resisting European dominance? And we do that. We also teach young people survival skills so that they can understand how to live and survive in an urban environment. We teach them organizing skills so that these young folks can learn how do you organize a community. How do you do simple things like petitioning and canvassing? How do you talk to folks? How do you try to get them involved in movement building? We teach them urban agriculture. We've taught them archery and a whole list of different things. Currently, the Scouts program and the Liberation program I'm working on is called Siafo Youth Corp. And I do that. I think this brother's been on your show before with Brother Kalanji. And together, us and a larger movement we call the Siafo Movement, we built the Siafo Youth Movement or Youth Cooperative. And through that, again, we try to teach young people how to organize and be diligent in what they have to do, and to not, as much as possible, for them not to feel like they're wasting their time on these streets, or they're not learning anything because school isn't teaching them about the real history of black resistance in this country. So we take a lot of pride and I've done, again, a lot of work over the years. And it's important that we create alternative educational models, because as we know, whether or not it's private school or public schools or charter schools, the education that our kids receive will not be based on knowledge around African history, around the history of Africans who've been enslaved here. There'll be a feel-good history about America, but it won't really teach people about how to survive America and how to prosper in our communities.
Okay. That's good work. What actually your definition of a community organizer? What does that actually mean to you, community organizer? What is it?
Well, community organizing, you know, at its basic level, is working with a community that's, you know, for lack of a better word, disenfranchised. It doesn't have resources. It doesn't have power. Other folks have power over it. And community organizing is working with the community like that and trying to help bring that community together, bring those people together, so that they can understand that their power lies in the fact that if they work together, they can make changes. And whether or not that's sort of short-term changes, things like policy work, or long-term changes, things like institution building, It's really about how do you bring folks together to have people have a common understanding of, you know, what our problems are, where they come from, who's responsible for them. And to be honest, you know, the folks that cause your problems are not going to be the same people that fix your problems. So unless we ourselves gather together and create these initiatives and organizations, our problems will always be in someone else's hands, whether or not that's the downtown politician, whether or not that's the capitalist developer, whether or not that's folks who are just mooching off the community. But unless the community feels like, folks in the community feel like they have an organizational apparatus that allows them to take control of, again, the institutions, to challenge institutions, to change policy, but more importantly, to gain control over their lives. So that's really what community organizing is. If I was to give a definition, it's around helping support folks to gain control over their lives. And again, you can do that through multiple ways. You can do campaign work. You can create institutions. But most importantly, you have to be in the Black community. You can't do it from a downtown studio. You can't do it online. You can't do it through Twitter. You can't do it through Facebook. You can't do it through Instagram. You have to be in the Black community on a day-to-day basis, see people, talk to people face-to-face, gain their trust, tell them and teach them what the things that you're doing, let them teach you and tell you the things that they're doing, and figure out what skills they have and what skills you have that can be mutually applied for the benefit of the larger Black community.
True indeed, true indeed. You know, it's very important to get out amongst people, to get to know the people, relate to people, live with the people, eat amongst the people, you know, to get an understanding, go out to these, be a solutionary to their problem, and also be able to point them to themselves so they can solve their own contradiction and condition. Because one thing about it, you can't go into the community, you know what I'm saying? You can't go into any kind of community and just present your ideas or your program, because people in the community have already been living there. They already got certain things they're doing already. It's on you to be an aid and assistant to be a social scientist and a solutionary to help them with their problems and ills, right? Which is a good thing.
Yeah, no, most definitely.
You know,
because I feel like a lot of times people come into the Black community and they feel like they have things that they're going to teach us. You know, we do this what I'm going to consider somewhat lame stuff, that we're going to do job preparation. We're going to teach people how to put on a tie, how to put on a suit, how to do a resume. And folks already know, is like, hey, you know, I can figure that stuff out. But we're not talking about no real resources. We're talking about me getting a job for $6 and change, $7 and change, $10 and change. If I'm lucky, that's not going to fundamentally change my condition. And if folks don't understand how they got there in the first place and what the work, the intense work that's needed to dig ourselves out of this hole that we didn't put ourselves in, but I stress, no one else is going to dig us out of that hole. No one else is going to bring a program to our community that's meant for liberation, that challenges systems of oppression. That's only going to come within the Black community.
True indeed, true indeed. Yeah, we're actually like Bobby Jaleel Moody King said, we're our own liberators. So it's all on us in our regards to what we're doing, right? You know, for anybody who's starting out anew in the grassroots organizing, right? What are some things that you would tell them in regards to reaching out, coming out, you know what I'm saying, first going to community and grassroots development, community organizing? What would you actually tell them?
I think the first thing I tell folks is that you got to read. You can have experiences which are extremely important. You can live a life that's embedded within like your own community. And that gives you a certain experiential knowledge. It gives you a certain know-how about how the community moves or how you move within it. You know who the players are and so forth. But if you don't have an understanding of why our communities are the way they are, who prospers from that, who benefits from that, you will come in with the wrong solutions to the wrong problems. So I think it's imperative that our young people continue to and or do more reading of the history of resistance, the history of oppression and white supremacy that's been practiced upon our communities and our neighborhoods, our people, so that they understand that the configuration of where we live is no accident. We didn't happen to be there. We're not there because we're not smart, not less smart than other people. We're not there because we don't have talents like other people. We're not there because we're not gifted like other people. We're there because we've been oppressed and we've been stuck into these communities. And then we believe the Horatio Alger story that because a few of us make it out of it, that somehow that means the system is fair and then we ourselves are just failing. And so we try to make sure, I think it's important for folks to make sure that that's the okey-doke, right? Just because one person makes it out, you got to look at the other 40,000 people who haven't made it out that community. And what is it? What is the structural issues in that neighborhood or in this country that's keeping our folks from prospering and doing well? So I stress to folks that you got to be able to understand the problem and read the problem. You can't take advantage of Black people. And again, I don't want to harp too much on some of the social media aspects of organizing these days, but too many times I think people who live in our neighborhoods, they're no longer fooled by some of this stuff. They've heard us come into these neighborhoods before with like some decent rhetoric, some good rhetoric. They've heard Malcolm. They've heard the best rhetoric they can ever hear. So they don't need us coming in there with more rhetoric. What they need are solutions or applications that show that the things that we're talking about can actually be achieved. So I tell people that they got to not only study the history, but they got to have some practical skills that they can apply in community organizing. It can't just be about marches and demonstrations, although that's a part of it. Obviously, it's not going to just be about voting, but what are the practical applications that you can bring to a community? How can you help build institutions that Black people run and control? As much as we think that organizations, and when we study history, we think about organizations like the Nation or like the UNIA, like the Panthers, they just didn't do things like demonstrations. In fact, for a lot of those organizations, demonstrations were secondary. Voting was secondary, if at all, attempted. What they really did was build institutions. And when Black folks in those communities talk about the things that they love most about sort of the historical precedents that's been set by these organizations, it is groups like the Panthers, like Marcus Garvey, UNIA, like even the Nation of Islam, sort of a contradiction some folks may still have with them. Those are the organizations that people remember and think steadfastly about as the ones that improved our conditions the most, and hence the ones that were ultimately tampered with, destroyed, messed with, and moved off of their path. So it's important that folks understand that you can't just come thinking that if you do some outreach and some voting that that's going to solve the problem. You got to dig deep into a community. I also tell people to young people, don't believe all the truisms about organizing. Some people say, oh, you got to come from that particular neighborhood to organize. And that may be good, but that doesn't mean that that's true for everybody and everything. We have to find communities that we can impact. And that may mean that it's important for some people to move from one place to another. You can't just do or say or suggest that just because someone is not from a particular local neighborhood that somehow they can't do good work in that community, because then that makes folks, that ostracizes, and that works for somebody else's plan. People sometimes, again, we get so beholden, or we believe, it's almost like it's a sports, like basketball, football, that we love these cities that we got no power in, and then if you ain't from my city, you can't teach me or show me anything or be a part of something. And that's just really, in my opinion, that's just really foolishness. So we got to understand the difference between people who are carpetbaggers who are coming to take advantage and people who are coming to be a part and really think about how we can make change. One of the organizations I didn't mention, but I think is truly left out when we think about sort of militant, grassroots, deep dive organizing, is SNCC. SNCC in the 60s went into the Black community and stayed there. They lived with people. They set up things like freedom schools. They did third parties, and they did organizing and grassroots institutions. So we have to learn from those organizations. Those organizations were correct in what they did. And that's why they went after and they were destroyed through COINTELPRO and other mechanisms, because they were correct in their analysis and they were correct in terms of the way they went about solving the problem. And I think those things are really important. Lastly, I do understand the importance of social media in today's world, but we cannot get fooled by thinking that just because some folks may have a following that may seem impressive, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know how to do community organizing, or quite frankly, that they're interested in community organizing. Sometimes people are far more interested in pontificating online they're far more interested in getting the likes, which may get them some other prominence in some other spaces. But we can't be fooled by thinking that because you got 50,000 followers, it's the same thing as you have in respect in the hood.
True indeed. True indeed. No, I understand that you do a lot of organizing. You're involved with various programs such as you organize collectives all the time for incarceration of prison, incarceration program, community gardens, police misconduct, and cop watch programs. Tell a little bit more about the incarceration programs. You know what I'm saying? What are you actually doing in regards to bringing awareness about mass incarceration and prison industrial slave camp and things? And what are you doing to bring the awareness?
Mm-hmm. I think the bio you're reading from is a lengthy bio of like my history of doing organizing. So it has everything that I've done either in the past or currently. And so, you know, I've done, as you mentioned, things like cop watches with the organization I was a part of. We did Know Your Rights trainings. We did, you know, similar to the Panthers, only we did with cameras and not guns. This was in Brooklyn, New York, where we watched the police when they stopped people to make sure that folks was all right. We did Know Your Rights seminars. We would go into prisons, not only to visit and support political prisoners, but to work with everyday prisoners who weren't politicized, and started some programs so that we can talk to them about their conditions and the things that's impacting them. I was an attorney. I practiced law for 10 years. I did criminal defense work. And part of that work that I did around mass incarceration, particularly on the outside, were preventing folks from going in. I think you're going to probably get to this a little later, but it's important now to just mention it, was that we did a big stop and frisk case. So I was part of a class action stop and frisk case in New York that ultimately led, way after I left the case, but ultimately led to a decision that called stop and frisk constitutional violation, particularly of black and brown young boys, their rights, as they were like stopped for no reason without reasonable suspicion or probable cause by NYPD. So currently, some of the work we do here in Atlanta is that we visit county jails and we talk to those folks. We offer them alternatives when they come out of jail, that they can come work with us in terms of community movement builders. And so that's the kind of stuff that we do on a regular basis.
Okay. That's good work.
Well, I'm an old man,
I've
done a lot of things.
Yeah, I understand you did work around the Freedom Campaign of Rakim Balogun, right? Can you tell a little bit about that program, the work you did around those issues?
Yeah, well, I did some stuff in the background, and I helped, you know, I feel like if folks don't know, so that's the brother who actually got charged as a black identity extremist about 2 or 3 years ago now. And he was picked up by the FBI on a gun charge. And the thing that was unique about him getting picked up is that he was someone who, and he's located in Dallas, Texas, and the organization Guerrilla Mainframe and the Huey P. Newton Gun Club. They did Second Amendment rights and talked about the right of black people to arm themselves for self-defense, and they open carried. And so they became a target for not only the local police, but the FBI. In fact, another brother who's closely associated with him lost two jobs because the FBI would go to his jobs and talk to his employers. And later his employers would say that they didn't like having that, and so they would let him go. In the case of Rakim, again, he was charged on a gun charge, and the thing that was unique about it was that when he went to court, and this, you know, this is as much as possible as you can call it a run-of-the-mill, he happened to forget that he had a weapon on him when he went to the airport, and so this wasn't like a charge around some involving some sort of violent act. It was simply in an open carry state. That he forgot that he had brought his gun with him. And so when he went to court, he wasn't given bail. He was denied bail. And so that became the unique aspect of it that led folks to understand that this was more than just a simple arrest, but this was the targeting of a brother who had been out into the streets organizing in Dallas, talking about the right to self-defense. And that's something that, you know, even amongst today's organizers, that's controversial. So I think one of the disappointing things is that Brother Rakim wasn't given widespread support amongst the so-called movement circles out here today because he wasn't doing, again, maybe simple policy work, or he was doing something that folks considered extreme. But people who got to understand that they felt that Black Lives Matter was being targeted, but this was the first actual arrest that seemed to be under the designation of a Black identity extremist label. And not enough support was given to this particular brother. And so because I knew some of the folks in his crew, I got a call and I did what I could in terms of the background help with media and just giving whatever advice I could to help support him. And luckily, he was able to get some great attorneys in Dallas, Texas, who are local to Texas, who took on his case and did some excellent defense work. And those charges wind up getting dropped before he even had to go to trial. And so it showed that that the FBI and the local police were actually not on a sound basis, and the judge actually were not on a sound basis in how they treated this case. And every now and then, when we have some experienced people in the courtrooms, we can sometimes flip these things and show the injustice, show the racism, and show again that our people who do organizing can become targets to the larger political apparatus that wants to keep our people from gaining our rights and exercising our rights.
True indeed, brother. It was the pig. Still at the brother, man. Brother still going through complications with the pig, right? You know.
Yeah.
Another thing I want you to touch on, man. You know what I'm saying? What actually the importance of community guards and how? How can community government use to create unity among the people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, community gardens, they're not the answer to everything that's happening in our community by no means. But what they do is they provide an entry point to have discussions around food sovereignty, food deserts, the importance of growing local. They're good training grounds for folks to understand the importance of like growing food and having access to food, as opposed to strictly depending on corner stores and supermarkets. They're also an opportunity to talk to people about healthy eating. Because a lot of times in our communities, when we say things like food deserts, what we're talking about is places where folks in our communities don't have access to healthy food items. They don't have access to vegetables and fruits as much as other communities, things that we know are ripe, that they're good for you to eat. Instead, what we have is a plethora of fast food restaurants in our communities that are cheap, they're fast, and so they become a place where, if you're tired after working, if you just got to do something really fast, they become that place where we go to and we depend upon. And I think community gardens, again, they allow for opportunity for organizing around food justice issues in our community. I think I stress that, I don't feel like community gardens by themselves are going to solve a lot of the problems that we have, but they allow us to start addressing and thinking about how do we make changes in certain aspects of how we eat, how we diet, where we get our food from. I will say in the South, community gardens can mean more because in the South, there are larger gardens, there are larger opportunities to do work that can have, like, can really grow larger amounts of food that we can get to people. And sometimes through community gardens, you can start that conversation also, I should say, around cooperative grocery stores and other ways of building larger institutions. So I think, for us, I always stress to people that I'm not a gardener by training. So I can't, and I'm from Brooklyn. So when I talk about the garden that we have, I'm careful to take a step back and ask the urban gardeners that we have who are professionals. They're into this stuff. They're in it night and day. Asking them to explain what we have and what we do in the garden. And for me, it's an opportunity to do organizing, to bring people around in the community so that they understand that we can do a lot of work together around something that seems it's safe, it's easy, but we can get down to some deeper issues in our community when we get folks out there.
True indeed. True indeed. Another thing I want you to touch on, right? Can you tell us exactly what police misconduct is, and how can we, and what is the solution to deal with it?
To be completely honest, you know, in America we have minimal rights. So, you know, I'm not going to, even as an attorney, certainly not going to stand here and tell people that we have rights that are being protected by the police. It's the opposite. The police take advantage of the loopholes in the law or the gray areas in the law that allow them a great deal of latitude when it comes to stopping people, asking questions, roughing people up, beating people up, and a lot of times killing people, because the police understand that they have the court system on their side, they have the prosecutors mostly on their side, they have the media on their side, and they have the elected officials and politicians on their side. So they understand that they have a great latitude in how they address the issues of crime and the issues of controlling a community, because usually the media puts everything in a framework of how dangerous our communities are. And so police misconduct basically is a violation, is when the police act in such a way that violates our constitutional rights. And therefore, if they're violating our constitutional rights, they're also violating our human rights. But under domestic law, what you concentrate on for the most part is constitutional rights. And that's, you know, the right to walk where you want to walk, talk how you want to talk, freedom of speech, freedom to gather, just freedom to assemble. A lot of times the police misconduct involves asking people questions or making demands of people that are against the law, or basically the people have a right to refuse, but they don't understand that they do have a right, or they've been too intimidated by the police to refuse certain demands that the police may have, including illegal searches, question asking, and people feeling compelled to answer those questions. And so those are some of the tips of the iceberg. Obviously, police misconduct goes all the way to beating people up, roughing people up, and obviously the history is of killing people in our community and getting away with it. So it's very important that it's a matter that's been worked on in our community since, you know, slave catchers, who later became organized police units, have been operating in and out of black communities and around black people. And it's been something that, you know, it's been a slight low, but over the last 5 or 6 years, obviously police misconduct took on a major role through organizing in the media and through Black Lives Matter, at least in creating an umbrella national movement. Obviously, it was organizers on the ground who for years have been working on this issue locally. But I give credit to the Black Lives Matter movement for having the ability to, at least for a time period, bring some national attention to the issue. But it's imperative that we as a community continue to be diligent, figure out what our rights are, figure out how do we protect our rights. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do is to do Know Your Rights workshops, so that folks can understand what their rights are. And sometimes that their rights are not going to be protected in that moment just because they know them, but it can help them later on if they happen to be arrested to say to their defense attorney, hey, you know what, this police officer started questioning me and telling me that I had to do ABC, and I told him, no, I didn't want to, but then he made me do it anyway. Well, that could be a violation of someone's rights, right? That this police officer started questioning me before he read me my Miranda rights. And therefore, I didn't realize that, and I started answering questions. So there's things that people don't understand that we have to educate them on that, again, that may not help them in that moment, but if they survive the initial encounter, then they can tell their defense attorneys. I know something that's controversial for actors is the idea of the body cameras, but I'm more or less a proponent of them because I think they give us more evidence to work on, and I'd rather have that than to rely strictly on police reports, which are easily changed, rewritten, they gather and come up with a conceptual story. At the very least with the cameras, we have some other information that may not always hold up in court because we have a racist court system, but may show the public again and show black people how we are being treated. Not that we always, that we need more documentary evidence, but it never hurts to continually show how our people are being violated by the police. I think doing cop watches are a great opportunity for us to learn how to organize and to do something as a unit and to be protective of our community. So going out and watching the police as they stop our folks in the community to make sure that we're standing a safe distance back so that we're not considered to be interfering, which gives the police some sort of questionable right to try to arrest those who are observing, but to make sure that we're observing, that we're documenting, that we can yell out instructions to the person getting arrested. If someone is with that person, we can get their information so that we can give these this documentation for eventually to either their family or the legal support so that these folks can have something that helps support them later on if they happen to be charged with something. I think those things were important. I even think the recent moves to organize to get more progressive, and again, this is a short-term thing, but to get more progressive district attorneys can be important in battling against mass incarceration, because there's been a little bit of a tide shift now. But this is not due to, I should stress this is not due to some sudden waking up of understanding the humanity of black people, but there has been a small tide in the turn against mass incarceration. A lot of that took place after or during the Great Recession, when states found it too expensive to hold so many people in jails and in their prisons, and then they started working on furlough programs and other things. And I should mention that the change started happening when white folks started taking drugs in greater numbers. And then the solution became, how do we find help and medical help and treat this as a medical condition and a disease as opposed to a crime? And so, that has by default impacted the large amounts of young African men and Latino men who are in prison in particular, because now they're trying to figure out ways to decrease the prison populations. And so, working on those strategies, a brother in Florida, Desmond Mead, led a campaign to restore the voting rights of folks who were incarcerated with felonies in Florida, and they won that victory. And so, again, these are pocket victories. They're not liberation in and of themselves. But what they do is provide us some short-term space so that we can create other institutions that allow us to protect ourselves from the police and allow us to stop the first encounters of mass incarceration before they take place.
True indeed. From your mind, I say in regards to police, men call police violence, things of nature. Do you actually feel that it'd be better to police your own community?
No, most definitely. I mean, I know. I think that's what we have to move to. When I said creating institutions, that's exactly what I mean. That we have to. It's going to be a struggle to do that for several reasons. One is because for the most part, we are a disorganized and poorly resourced community. And so until we figure out how to create these alternative institutions, we have to do some other stopgap measures. But ultimately, we have to be able to control the policing institutions of our community. I say to folks that if there's an institution in your community that you don't control, That's an institution that either you have to gain control, you have to destroy. And that goes particularly, that's particularly true for a policing institution because they have the power to arrest, they have the power to charge, they have the power to kill, they have the power to incarcerate. So they have bodily power over us as human beings. And if you, and if we as a people don't control those institutions, then we don't have a right to hire people and to fire people, to discipline people, to make sure that folks understand basic humanity in terms of dealing with folks in the street, to understand that we are the ones who pay the salaries of these folks who have guns and badges and operate under the color of the law, that we are the ones who pay their salaries. We are the ones who buy those uniforms. We are the ones paying for those guns. If we cannot figure out how to control those institutions, then we must destroy those institutions and we must create our own policing institutions. I just think that's something that as we have to do that, as we're doing some of these other things, because we can't act like these police forces don't have power in our community, because they do. We can't act like our people don't feel dependent on these police forces, because they do. When something happens, and if we do to ourselves or something along those lines, you know, our folks call the police because that's the standing institution that has the resources to come and to respond to things. And so until we start building those alternatives, we have to put them at bay, but at the same time start to build these alternative institutions that people can feel like that is also a way that I can respond to injury or get some redress or some restorative justice by dealing in another way with my people. So we have to control that policing institution, and quite frankly, we have to gain control of our larger culture, so that we can control the conditions in which we live in, the things at which we practice and that our folks grow up in, and so that we can see that there's different ways that we can sort of express dissatisfaction or express ourselves when arguments come or disagreements happen. And so it's not turned into, you know, we just throwing up hands or doing something worse than that. Which again brings in third parties to come after us in our community.
True indeed. You know, it's very, very interesting, you know, especially when there's a lot of things that people don't know they actually can do legally in the community in regard to organizing. Let me stop you right there
because you're right. People don't know, I know you're about to ask a question, but I got excited. People don't know that, you know, you can film the police. You can film the police. You can take down, you can ask them about what their badge numbers are. You can write down their squad car numbers. You can file complaints with civilian complaint review boards. Again, those things aren't going to necessarily solve every problem, but they will start to put the police on notice that there is a diligent community that is actually starting to see that these harassing tactics won't go unpunished, that we will stand up and we will be vigilant and watching what's happening and start to figure out ways to protest. In New York, you know, we do protests in front of the precinct. We would go file complaints with folks. We would, as an attorney, I would sue the police on behalf of people who were victims of police misconduct. So we provided that kind of support for folks when they needed support from us as a community-based organization.
Sure, indeed. You know, the thing I want to ask, can you tell us a couple of laws or a couple of statutes that people don't know that they're asking, that New Africans can actually use in regards to dealing with the law or using to have a better stance in legal matters?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, even though each state has different laws, what the Constitution provides are a sort of a base level or a floor that the police, no matter where they are not supposed to violate. And one of the things that we do as folks who are sometimes uninformed is that we give up more information than we need to. So, you know, as a good defense attorney, whether my client is guilty or innocent, then we get the same advice. If you are ever arrested by the police, you are not going to talk your way out of that situation. So you never volunteer information. Miranda rights are They don't have to be read to you unless the police are going to question you. So if you volunteer information to the police, that can assuredly get used against you. So people have to always understand, you know, you give it's, you know, if you're akin to being behind or captured by behind enemy lines, you give your name, rank, and serial number, right? You tell them, you can tell them what your name is, where you live, and if you have a job. But that's really that's the discussion that you have. You don't have a discussion about your case. You wait to speak to either a legal aid attorney or until you get a private attorney, or you even wait until you get out and you can talk to family members. But you don't just start by telling the police a story of this is what happened and that was happened. Also, people should remember that the police are legally allowed to lie to you. They're allowed to take you in one room, take your friend who got maybe arrested with you in another room, and say, look, your friend is over there just told me that you did everything. You did this, you did that. You plant A, you plant B. And then you start going, oh, no, 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 that's not what happened. What happened was this, what happened was that. He said this and we said that. So that alone right there gets you locked into a statement and you're giving up information where you don't need to. So when people say you have the right to remain silent, you need to use it. On the street, the police do not have a right to search you unless they have probable cause. So they can't just pull up on you and go through your pockets, although we know that that's really what happens. What's important is by knowing that that's not the law, is that unless the police have what's called reasonable suspicion to stop you, and this is a case where it's not a straight out arrest, and they don't have probable cause to arrest you, they have to have something what's called reasonable suspicion, an articulable objective criteria in which they're suggesting that a crime is afoot. And what that really means is that there is something in what you did that causes suspicion. And even doing that, they can walk up and ask you questions, and you still have a legal right not to answer those questions. But they're not allowed to search you unless they can articulate a reason that they think their life is in danger. And what the police did, and you can't prevent them from searching you. So I don't say something like this to tell you that if a cop puts his hands on you, that if you're by yourself, but in particular, that you should be pushing that cop's hands away, right? What you should do is document in your head how the scenario went down. Did the cop walk over to you, push you up, and just take everything out your pocket and start searching you? And let's say, you know, you're in a state where weed is still illegal or something like that, or it hasn't been decriminalized, and they find something, they use it to arrest. You can tell your criminal defense attorney later on, look, this cop just threw me against the wall and started pulling things out of my pocket. He didn't give me any, and there was no justifiable or articulable reason. I was just walking down the street. Those things can be used to get something thrown out, and they can be used as actionable for you getting a civil rights attorney to sue the police. People don't understand too. You know, you can sue the police for false arrest. If you spend 24 hours, even less than that, you can get $5,000, $7,000, $10,000 because the police falsely arrested you. And you shouldn't let those things drop. Not only do you need the extra money probably, but, you know, we need to make sure that this is documented somewhere in this cop's file so that they, if it happens again and again, at least there's a track record that can potentially allow that cop to get fired. So those are some of the most important things that people need to understand when dealing with the police. That there are certain rights that you may have, which may not be safeguarded at the time of the incident. But if you can remember what it was and how it was happening, you can potentially help yourself later on.
Sure, indeed. True, indeed. A good information, right? A good information.
I think so, yeah.
That'd be information because, you know, it should be a lot of time that, especially in regards to community organizing, grassroots organizing, right? It'd be a lot of time that you go into the community and people won't be doing certain things because they're not aware that they can do certain things. And it'd be a lot of benefits and knowing certain laws or how they can utilize to maneuver better in a particular area, in a particular locale, by knowing certain things they can do, you know, what the legal system is not going to tell you because they want to keep you oppressed. They don't want to tell you a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. It's all a good thing.
No, most definitely. Yeah, I mean, most definitely. I think the police purposefully You know, they try to do as little as possible to help you understand what your rights are when coming in contact with them. The district attorney's office tries to do as little as possible to make sure that you understand what your rights are when coming in contact with them. And that's because their goal is to not only charge you, but to get a conviction. What the district attorney cares about, for the most part, is getting convictions. It's not about finding the truth. It's about getting a conviction, because that's a track record that they can run on. That's a track record for promotion. That's a track record for judgeship. It's how it's like we arrest and we get convictions. You know, the truth may or may not happen or come out. There may be some diligent folks. I don't want to paint too much of a broad brush, but too many times the idea of getting a conviction is what drives and motivates both the police and the district attorney's offices. And so if they don't have to tell us what our rights are, and in a lot of cases they don't, we have to figure out what those rights are, again, through doing Know Your Rights workshops, through looking up the law, through making sure that we have some clear understanding that we have to protect our rights, we have to protect ourselves, and we have to show that we can be organized to do collective protection of those rights, because individually doing it doesn't make that big of a difference or impression upon folks. But when you are collectively organized to protect yourself and protect your community, then that is what brings people to have to negotiate with you, to have to deal with you on a different level, and whether or not they deal with you in a way that's good or not, but at least they're going to have to deal with you in a way that they don't do it with us as an individual, they don't currently do with us as a people.
True indeed. My next question here is right. Can you tell me how important is political education in the community? How important is it?
There's been times in my life where I downplayed the importance of political education because I wanted to get the work done. You know, the work seemed more practical, of like talking to people and setting up programs and institutions and doing campaigns and stuff like that. But I backtracked a little bit on that because I understand that unless people really understand the problem, right, they really understand the circumstances, they understand the history, they understand that there's the alternatives to a capitalist system, the alternatives to oppression, the alternatives to white supremacy. Unless they understand Pan-Africanism, they understand socialism, they understand cooperative economics, they understand militancy, they understand collective thinking around making demands and institution building, once again, that we need to understand a context in which those things come out of and why they're so important, and how other people have organized to create their own institutions, which, again, they'll let like a talented tenth of us get in so that the rest of us can think that, oh, if they can do it, we can do it too. Or those folks who made it start telling us how great the system is, and if we only participated more in the system or we stopped complaining and doing other things, that we too could be just like them, as if all of us could play basketball or be an actor or make $1 million. And, you know, it's those few people, whether they mean well or not, that they perpetrate a lie. And because we're not politically astute enough, because we haven't been politically educated enough, that we don't study our history of our organizations and the resistance and the institutions that have been used to oppress us, because we don't understand those things the way we should, and we don't look for alternatives, you know, we get easily kind of, using a Malcolm word, hoodwinked back into believing that some very simple answers are going to cause us liberation when they won't. Like when people think that voting for a Democrat over a Republican is going to cause us liberation. I'm not saying that to say don't vote. I'm not saying that to say that it's not some slight and or some important differences, but there's surely a difference between thinking that getting the oppressor's foot off of your neck a little bit is not the same thing as liberation. And we have to be able to make that distinction, because then otherwise we'll use the tools that we have, like voting, in a way that doesn't advance our interests, but we'll use it as a catch-all for everything and anything that we want to do to gain freedom and liberation, when that tool certainly won't give us that.
True indeed. You know, it's all about educating the mind and master the people so they make their own conscious decision exactly what you want to do, because it's only one, it's only two sides. You know, you either with liberation and the freedom, or you're not. It's basically mm-hmm. everything in my mind. So the education mm-hmm. is always a good platform, especially jumping toward the youth, going toward the youth, because the youth are the future, enlightening them and educating them so they can make conscious decisions themselves to be better solutionaries or to their own problem, the issues in their own communities, and help build them communities up, which is that's a great thing. We have access to, especially we're in this new era of technology sophistication. A lot of the youth are basically technology savvy. It's always good. It'd be good to utilize to point them in a particular direction, so they can gain the insight in the education, the history, and the science, and everything that they need. But you to gain them in a particular to point them in a particular direction, due to the fact that we know the enemy control, controlling the propaganda and manipulating the propaganda. So every time. And it's always on us to control and manipulate the narrative so that people can see things from a particular perspective in which we're showing them, so they can gain a better understanding of exactly what's going on in the struggle for liberation, struggle for independence, the struggle for land, and the other struggles we fight for, right? So it's like it's on our duty to inform them. It's about any means necessary. If not, we're not doing our duty. Okay? You look at our people and our condition, you know. If our people are hungry and they don't have any food, things of that nature, right? You know, you can't go to telling them, oh, we got this program, this and that, or you're gonna take such and such, you're gonna take this to do this. They're looking for something tangible at that particular time. Now, if you got some something like storage or something passing out free food or stuff like that, that's a possible solution at that particular time, right? But if you don't get a solution at that particular time, our people not trying to hear what you got to say. You know, they're not trying to deal with you. You know, like you spoke about earlier, the importance of the institution building. Those are some of the things we lack. We don't have particular institutions. And particular institutions can be particular ideology within our own mind state that can push us forward as well, not just a physical building. You know, and it's because that's where it starts at in regards to the methodology in which we're going to approach the problem solution. Being solutions to our problems and developing solutions to our problems and issues. Cause the majority of the time we all know what they are. But the thing is working to resolve them. And one of the things we've been lacking over the years in working to resolve them is unity, right? I want to ask you, what does unity look like? What does unity mean to you? What does it look like to you?
And right before I get there, I wanted to follow up because I think the basic thing that we have a problem understanding is the idea of what propaganda is, both propaganda that's used against us and propaganda that we should be using. So people don't understand, like when you talk about the Panthers free breakfast program, what was special about the free breakfast program wasn't necessarily just the breakfast. Obviously, that was important, but it was the political education that came with the breakfast, because what California later did was adopt free breakfast models, but they took the politics out of it. And because they had so much more resources, they could do that. And at the same time, the Panthers were being destroyed. So we have to understand propaganda models and how they work both domestically and how they work internationally. How we're constantly pointed to and told that certain international actors are our enemies because they seem to be the enemies of the United States government. And then we believe that because those folks are called evil or bad people, or they're this and they're that, that without doing any fact checking on our own, we don't understand the history of American imperialism, which has overthrown governments, which has built alternative armies, which have gone in and challenged governments, which have killed organizers, peasant workers, labor activists. There's a whole history of the U.S. government doing that stuff, but using a propaganda arm. And because we're not politically educated enough, we fall for that propaganda arm. Now, getting back to the question of unity, you know, we must have unity without uniformity, and that's the famous Baraka comment. Because you know, we are even though we have much in common, particularly our Western us as Western New Africans, Africans here in the West. You know, there's going to be some differences between us, and those differences can't be enough to destroy what we need to build. It's so easy these days. You know, we build these formations, particularly at the street level, these grassroots organizations, and because we've been trained in this sort of individualist thinking, if the moment something goes wrong, we're ready to leave those organizations or those institutions. The moment we don't get our way, we're willing to say, I'm not down with it no more. The moment we get into a disagreement and a fight, or we have a partnership or love affair that goes wrong, we're ready to break out and to leave and to do that kind of stuff. And so unity is not just political unity around our common beliefs and ideology, because that's extremely important. But a lot of times the breakup of our organizational apparatuses, they're couched in political terms, but what they're really about are personal matters that we've been too immature to deal with in terms of how we get over them and deal with them. And again, to have disagreements and work through them and to keep it going. So for me, unity is not necessarily about believing the exact same thing as the other person in the organization I'm in. I'm sophisticated enough to understand that we're going to have some different belief systems, but we're going to have enough of an overlap around what's important to us. And in my case, there would be things like self-determination, like you talked about, liberating land and territory, having institutions that we own and control, creating political bodies that we own and control, being anti-capitalist, but understanding how market systems work and how we still have to use those, being pro-socialist, constructing institutions that are collective in nature. Those are the things that I gather and I organize around. To be quite honest, I really don't care about people's, I don't want anybody oppressed because of their sexuality or their gender. What I want is unity around certain political themes, and I want people who are mature enough to understand that even when we don't agree on things, that if we have enough overlapping politics around some of the essential themes, that becomes bigger than whatever some of our personal and even some of our political differences is. One of the best things that I compliment our enemy on in terms of them building the state is that they created a political apparatus that allows differences in opinion that, for the most part, holds together their political and governmental apparatus. So they've created wings of theories and thoughts, whether or not those extremes are allowed between the Democrats and Republicans. They created a paradigm in which those discussions and disagreements can happen. And they may not be able to go outside that paradigm, but enough of a paradigm where they have, at least up into a recent history now, you know, post the Civil War, but now recent history, which is in danger of falling apart because of demographic shifts. But they've allowed themselves space to have disagreements on some issues, but have enough in common around their beliefs that they need to dominate the world and their imperialism and their capitalism and their white supremacy and their control over all major resources, that's the stuff that keeps them together, even if they disagree about whether how much rights either some black or brown person should have today or tomorrow.
True indeed. Again, bro, I want to thank you for coming to our broadcast right now. There was an understanding. It's exactly 9:08. Are you available for any more callers, or do you have any more time?
Yeah, I carved out a little extra time. I begged and pleaded with my wife to let me get a little extra time to talk a little more to you. So, yeah, I got a little more time.
Okay. At this time, I'm going to open the line for any callers. If you have any questions or comments, a statement for the guest, please press 1. At this time, you had a question or comment for the guest, please press 1. I'm going to see what's up. Let me open the line, man. Let me see. Two people got to say. Okay. 313-459. Your line is open. You have a question or comment for the guest, please do so at this time. 313-459. Your line is open. You have a question or comment for the guest, please do so at this time. 313-459. Your line is open. Okay. Let's see what's happening. Okay. Got a couple of the 111 numbers. Let me see. Okay. 111. Your line is open. If you have a question or comment for the guest, please do so at your time. 111. Your line is open.
Greetings from the black ground.
Greetings.
How are you doing? I'm doing. My name is Elder Mama Condi, and I was about 7 or 8 minutes late. I've heard the majority of your presentation, brother, but I missed what your name is. Could you please reiterate that for me?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Kamal Franklin, and I'm a community organizer, and currently I'm helping to build an organization called Community Movement Builders, and we have chapters in Dallas, Detroit, and Atlanta, Georgia, and soon we're going to have another chapter on the West Coast, if all goes correctly. The organizing that we do, I should state this, we do community organizing. The thing that we're doing right now in Atlanta is around the issue of gentrification, and then we're developing cooperatives and micro businesses to help sustain the members of the organization and the local community that we're working in.
Where are you located?
Currently, I'm located in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I am blind. I'm multiply disabled, in a wheelchair, fully atrophied, amongst other things. But I do have a history prior to my present condition, which was partly caused by a false incarceration. But fortunately, I do have a history of revolutionary activism prior to my present condition, so I can at least be proud of that. What I'd like to ask of you is, one, do y'all have any books or information, especially in an audio format? For somebody like me, I still want to know what's going on, but because I'm blind, it's hard to get information anymore unless I come to venues like George Jackson University.
I guess it's at some point, if the brother gets your information, we can definitely point you to not just videos that have audio, but different recordings of some of the work that we've done or some of the interviews that we've given that highlight the work that we're doing. We can definitely do that because we have a few videos that talk about, our anti-gentrification work, our youth organizing. I should also mention that we have a community house in Atlanta that we own, that we do organizing out of, that we have an urban farmer who lives in the house who takes care of the garden. We have another organization that rents from us that does a child care cooperative downstairs on the first floor. And so we have some videos and some audio that documents some of that work. So I'll try to figure out how to get that to you then, sis.
Excellent. My next comment or question, you're in Georgia. I have 16 children. My oldest son is 54. My baby is 29. My daughter that lives in Atlanta, Georgia is, she's 37. So I want to be able to have her be able to communicate with you and your organization. So I'm looking forward to being able to be in touch so that she would have that ability to do so. And one of the things that I find intriguing, especially now that I'm blind, when I came out of incarceration, what I noticed was my community, which was two blocks, and it was all black. I've recently gone back, and it's all white except three homes. So I'm struggling with the idea of black community.
Mm-hmm.
And where, I mean, is this just a psychosocial reality now? Or, I mean, where is the black community?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there still are black communities. They've just been pushed out of central cities. And that's part of what's happening with this gentrification, where you have young white folks and other whites who fled, who are now coming back to the central cities and laying claim on those cities with the help of city governments and the help of local developers, who have now decided that they're going to turn these central cities into playgrounds for middle-class folks and push out, in particular, black working class folks and poor folks. Here in Atlanta, you know, I came here at the tail end of when all the public housing was destroyed. And this was done under black leadership, so-called black elected officials who said they were doing things in the best interest to help stabilize and create a black Mecca. And it's under their leadership here in Atlanta in particular that the city of Atlanta has gone from a population of close to, if not over 60%, to one that's barely 50% black. In addition to that, these Democrats who claim to have the best interests of our community, these so-called liberal and progressive Democrats who stand strong on national topics like immigration, who make great commentary these days on issues of race. We even talk about reparations sometimes these days. We talk about they wanting support working class people. But when you look at these same politicians, particularly at a local level, they've done nothing for the most part around the issue of gentrification in black communities. They've allowed these local developers to take over these communities, real estate developers to take over these communities, to allow the tax base to be changed so that people can no longer pay taxes. They've allowed the mortgages to increase because the values have increased, the rental values have increased, which have thrown people out of their neighborhoods or made people leave. And even when people think they're getting a good dollar by selling their houses, usually even the profit that they make does not allow them to move closer within the city, but instead they still have to move further out. Which leaves them prey to not having the same public transportation that they once had in central cities and or access to as many jobs. So what's happening right now is that there is a breakup of so-called inner-city black communities that is happening under the watch, for the most part, of our so-called allies, the Democrats, and the folks who claim to be representing us, black elected officials, particularly in places like Atlanta. And so I think, you know, we're entering a very dangerous time because we are being pushed out of these central cities and we're having to create these new communities, which, again, if we don't do it correctly, we don't do it right, the same thing is going to happen in 10 or 15 years when these same folks decide or their children decide that they want to now move outside the city, they're going to push us back someplace else. So until we have some control over land, over housing, over resources, that can develop businesses, you know, we're going to always be at the whim of these larger forces, which we don't have control, and which even those who claim to represent us really are at the feet or at the foot of these more powerful folks and do their bidding and not the bidding of the people who elected them in the first place.
I hope you don't mind. I have another question.
I'm totally up to you and the host.
Thank you. With eminent domain and taxation, the reality is that black folks never own their house or their land. And so how do we deal with that reality that even though we bought and paid for this home or this land, they can, the system can still come in and either take it or do what they want with it. For example, like they've done the so-called Native Americans out on the West Coast, they ran pipes under their sacred lands, and they're running pipes under the land that Bill Cosby owns upstate. So how do we address that? What organizing can we do to address eminent domain and how white people are continuing to control what we think we own?
Well, I think, you know, it's eminent domain is one tool, right? It's one tool that they have. They have other tools that they use too, which is selling city land to developers, and giving them tax breaks, and then they build these residential towers or condos that our folks can't afford, which again drives up the tax base, which means that the house next door to it, where you used to pay maybe $800 a year on your taxes, now you got to double that, and then soon you got to triple that. The community house that we bought in a working class black neighborhood here in Atlanta called Pittsburgh, we bought that house four years ago, for $60,000. Today that house has been valued at $200,000, and we haven't done that much improvement in the house for it to be overvalued to that nature. So what you have are markets that we don't control. What you have are political institutions that we don't control. And what you have is the lack of a political education that tells us that we have to collectively make changes. Otherwise, we're going to act as individuals and just sell and move someplace else, or hope that, you know, that this gentrification helps our home values increase, when really what it's doing is changing the complexion of our communities. And when they bring in these box stores and these coffee houses and these dog parks, and they tell you how they're building parks and all the green spaces, and that's to improve a community, note that those improvements are not meant for the current residents of those communities. They're meant for the new residents that they hope to move in soon. So to me, the central thing that we have to do is to create organizations that have power, organizations that are militant, organizations that know how to get some resources and use those resources to improve the lives of other working class black people. And until we do that, we will always be the victim of more powerful forces. We will always be the victim of people who have stronger militaries or police or economic apparatuses. And so at this stage in our history, if we don't do that, then we're going to be in the same place, like I said, another 10 or 15 years and move someplace else. We're going to be happy with seeing a few black folks in high places. But we have to understand that those black folks don't control the institutions that have matter in our community. And when it comes down to it, a lot of those black folks who we celebrate, they're more interested in keeping their wealth because they think they're special than they are in saving or protecting the larger black community. And so until we figure that part out, that's the major thing that we have to do. We have to figure out how to organize. We have to figure out how to grow. We have to figure out how to stick together and create that unity that the brother posed a question about. Because until we do that, others will take advantage of us because they've already created that unity. They're sitting up there laughing at how hard it is for us to do what they've already done. And we have to be the ones who have to put a stop to it, because no one else is going to come rescue us but us.
I'm really enjoying your responses to my questions. I've been doing, especially now that I'm blind, a lot of research using books that are audio-based. And what I've been researching lately is lands that were owned by us as a people here. I found out that Miles Davis's grandfather owned 500 acres of land, and the white folks around him were so jealous they ran him off his land and took it. I mean, there are thousands of stories like that. And I found that there are a minimum of 50 black towns and territories in every state. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of land that we owned. The Ouachita Moors have already claimed the illegal Louisiana Purchase. The Provisional Government Republic of New Africa has claimed the five states in the Black Belt South. And I'm thinking, if we learn law in terms of fighting whatever cases we're fighting, in their system, and learn the law on an international level, since international law supersedes all civil laws, including federal, might we have a chance to gain control over all the land and get all of our land back?
Well, let me be blunt about that. The direct answer to that is no. And I'm a lawyer. I'm a lawyer. I practice law.
Bless your heart. You know, that was,
you know,
that was an intentional question, so I thank you.
Oh,
go ahead,
okay.
I'm listening.
You know, the law is created by the people who are in charge. It's not the opposite way. It's not like the people who are not in charge get to create the laws, and therefore the laws work out for those who are oppressed. And so, again, you know, people who, there are genuine disputes that get solved through the law, but the law doesn't shift power from one group of people to another, which is not to say that the law can't help support an underlying respect for people's humanity, but the law in and of itself doesn't shift power. What shifts power is revolution. What shifts power is people having unity and having a political organization and political astuteness to understand that they must control resources near them and close to them. And what you have lost will not be gained back through the apparatus of Western law, nor the apparatus of international law for the most part. Not there might be some things around the edges that we can gain some victories out of, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, we're one court case away from winning our rights and winning our freedom and our liberation. No one's going to hand us our liberation. That's going to be something that we're going to have to gain through our organizing, through our institution building, through the organizations that we create, the militancy, our ability at this stage to either buy new land, to seize new land, and be able to hold it. So that, and it's going to take militant force, as in an organization that has the strength and the power and the backing, not necessarily the majority of our people, but a critical mass of our people, so that people understand, so people understand that when it comes time to protecting what we've gained, that there's going to be sacrifices on both sides if it comes to that. So it's not the law in and of itself that's going to supply our ability to protect ourselves or gain our rights or help us get land and help us get property and help us get resources. That's going to take our brain power. That's going to take our organizing power. That's going to take our ability to stay true to the cause and not to sell out and buy ourselves out and be bought out in certain situations. So, you know, I think the law is one of those things that's a tool for us, but it is not the tip of the spear that's going to lead us to get back to things that we've lost. And on that note, I think I am going to have to call it an evening very soon. But I wanted to thank you so much for your questions. I think they were great. And I definitely wanted to figure out a way to get you some of that material that we spoke about.
I think Bomani will be able to help us. Bomani?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I can make something happen. I can make something happen.
Thank you.
Brother Kamali, I want to thank you again for coming to our broadcast here tonight. We understand it. What are your final thoughts for the show? What are your final thoughts you're going to leave her with?
Brother, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on and for letting me participate. It's always great to speak to people who I know are fellow travelers who are doing this work. If folks want to reach us at Community Movement Builders, they can go to our website at communitymovementbuilders.org and leave a message, our Facebook page, and all that kind of stuff so that they can get in touch with us and help us build future chapters. If they don't want to join our organization, tell us what your organization is doing and how we can be a part of that work that they're doing. I think the big thing, you hit the nail on the head with a couple of the things that you asked about, is that we got to have strong political education. We have to figure out how to gain some unity amongst ourselves, and we've got to be smart enough and intelligent enough to build institutions and organizations that have strength and militancy, that are ready to fight and not to cower in the face of our enemies. So I appreciate you having me, brother.
True indeed, brother. Appreciate you and your work and things you're doing in the present, things you're doing in the future. And for all those who have any loved ones, associate, friends, or car behind enemy lines, please check our website, which is www.georgiauniversity. Again, it's www.georgiauniversity. Long live the spirit of resistance, long live the independent movement, long live the spirit of Comrade George Jackson, and free the land.
Free the land. Take care, brother.
So, by the minute, sir.
Let's go. Ghetto children singing, see, they eager to learn how to become the next world leaders, brave hearts, revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off here, revolutionary warfare is all fair, loving war for the cause, I gotta take you off here, book one, strategy, tactics, techniques. Look dumb, but massively notice the weakness in all them. Got a new show me if necessary. Homie, investors is very real if enemies carrying heavy steel. Beware the thugs who ain't scared of blood or jail time. When Aryan nations ain't having integration, we so blind the beauty of life. Was when my mom said, if you could be Christ, I wasn't old enough to hold my MP right. Jesus, what is he like? I picture him standing with diamonds on him, little different from the way my mommy saw him. Practice your aiming, physical training in difficult terraining. Test your endurance, try to keep your stamina. Banging, splitting duchess up, strap up. The armies of school, teaching smart ways to go. I'm thinking Gandhi was a fool, the chronic's a fool. Got me thinking out loud. Sleep on my drunkenness, I blow your brains out. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare, warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here.
My revolution is as real as Bobby Seals. I build with dudes and Chris worth a quarter mil and Dick Hill. For fish gills, the cops, the time come, I mask up and get my comrade off the bus. Up the beef, I snatch a seed from Chuck E. Cheese and feed them to the rats in the back of the peas. Black fatigue and off the scenes on a sofa. 50-inch flat screen, Louis Vuitton holster. My motions don't appeal to appellate division. I did it strong for 7 long years in prison. Of the system, I'm like a modern-day Hitler. Black gorilla, crib and blood in one only. Just know my face, I be the case for the wish at the police. Look at the name Lake. Go simultaneously with street revolution. 21 gun salute, the new Huey Newton.
Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is warfare, loving war for the cause. I gotta take you off here. Teach our woman how to hold a family down in case something happens to us fathers. Protect the children, grab revolvers. The woman plays an important part of our life force. So what we fight for, my heart goes to you, beautiful wife in war.
Enlist in more and talk less. Watch all and trust none. Demand your respect. And be ready to die for what you believe in. And ride all the time, not just when convenient.
Justice and freedom. Wisdom and understanding. We the lost children of Israel in this Western world region. You ain't a man, you a coward if you can't support the girl you put a seed in.
Strong rule the weak, but the wise rule is strong. It's more to a war than just getting it on. Seal your form, cover your tracks, stay prepared. I don't care, no one's spared.
Revolutionary warfare.
I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is all fair. Love and war for the cause, I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is all fair. Love and war for the cause, I gotta take you off here. Revolutionary warfare is all fair. Love and war for the cause, I gotta take you off here.